This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books and Political Science podcast. Today, I am joined by one of our former hosts, Heath Brown, to talk about his new book, Homeschooling the Right, How Conservative Education Activism Erodes the State. This was published in 2020 by Columbia University Press and is a really fascinating book about politics and homeschooling. But I'm going to let Heath talk about that. First, I'd like to welcome Heath back to the New Books and Political Science podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this project. Hi, Heath.
Yeah, I am so excited to come on and talk about the book. But even before the book, I'm so excited to be a part of this, the network of the New Books Network, and also so thrilled by what this channel, the New Books and Political Science podcast is and has become and will become in the future. And you guys are doing such an amazing job that I am nervous to do this episode because of the incredible high quality that you guys are producing at. So thank you for having me on. I remain at the City University of New York, affiliated both with John Jay College and also the CUNY Graduate Center. My research, which some people view as varied and disparate, in fact, is always and ultimately connected back to two themes, which I'll be talking about today. One of the themes is the intersection between public policy and politics. And the second theme is the role of organizations in how policies are made. And so I've talked about that in lots of different ways. And in this case, I'm talking about it in the situation of homeschooling, a project that I started back before homeschooling became a household word phrase. When I started the project, most people that I talked to about the book would say, like, what are you talking about? I don't know what that is. Or maybe I once heard of somebody who was homeschooling their children. That is not the case now. A year or more into the pandemic, find a person who doesn't have some close experience with homeschooling, and you'll be lucky because it's just become such a important part of the delivery of education over the last year for not the best reasons, but it does cast the book in a different light. So I'm thrilled to talk more about the book.
And what you're talking about is not necessarily what we were all sort of surprised to find ourselves doing last April when all the schools in the United States and around the world more or less shut down and sent children home to be homeschooled. You are talking about sort of a political movement that sort of started in the 70s, but really picked up steam in the 1980s and 90s, that is connected to the Reagan Revolution and the religious right. Can you talk a bit about not the most recent experience that we've all had, but that sort of political dynamic?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And the book is focused very much on the conservative wing of the homeschooling movement, not the homeschooling movement overall, though many of the lessons can be generalized to that. But what I try to do, especially early in the book, is track this movement to allow people to voluntarily opt out of typically public education, public schooling for their children. And that's something that is, on the one hand, has long historic roots. But when we talk really about the homeschooling movement, we're really talking about a movement that started in the 1970s, really evolved in the 1980s, and became really a political player in the 1990s. And all of this goes back to an effort of parents, initially parents of a variety of ideologies, who were interested in educating their kids at home. And there's lots of different reasons for it, but for conservative homeschool families, especially conservative and also religious homeschool families, there was a clear motivation to move their kids out of some of the problems that they saw in public schools. And those ranged. But what initially started as a relatively ideologically diverse movement, and we're talking now about the early 1980s, becomes a movement that's really dominated by ideological conservatives. And even though the numbers of homeschooled kids in the country to this day remains relatively low, the political influence of some of the most powerful organizations across the country at the national, but also the state and local level, has really been outsized. And that's in part because of how much synergy there is between what homeschooling advocates talk about and other issue areas. And we can talk about those. But it's those overlaps that makes this sometimes hidden political movement into something that has had major impacts. We can talk about some of the details of that, but that's really what the book is about. Is about this 40-odd year political history of this policy that is the right to homeschool your children, that grows from just a handful of families to more, aided by organizations, and today remains influential and important.
One of the points that I found really interesting as you develop the sort of thesis of the book and discuss it in the book is what you call sort of the parallel politics. And that essentially what's going on is that you have our normal or expected, sort of debates around education, public education, funding, what's taught, the curriculum. And that at the same time, during this sort of rise of homeschooling, you have a parallel development of the same kind of infrastructure, or at least a similar kind of infrastructure. And I found that really interesting because in part, I had never thought of it in that way, that it was an exact mimic in a certain sense of the policy sphere, the public policy sphere. But this is now kind of a private public policy sphere. Is that an accurate characterization? And can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's accurate. And I would love to quote you at some point, because I think you've done a great job of summarizing what took me pages and pages and pages to try to explain. And I think that's exactly right. And this is one of the paradoxes here, that when a family decides to take their children, let's say, out of a public school or a private school, really, we might expect for them to kind of drop out, in part because they are opting out of what just about everybody else takes advantage of, participates in, which is the common conventional neighborhood, often neighborhood public school. But when a family does that, they face a lot of trouble, which is how do you educate kids at home? And all of us, including parents and non-parents now, can much more closely relate to this because over the last year, many families have had to do this very thing. But imagine doing this voluntarily. Imagine doing this during a time before the internet when you could pull up Wikipedia and find out about any topic in the world. But think about the 1980s when we're talking about a pre-internet time period where parents would make this decision and then they were faced with the conundrum. So what do we teach? How do we teach math? How do we teach language arts? How do we teach history or biology or what have you? And what naturally, almost I would argue, inevitably grows up around these families is a rich civil society filled with dozens and dozens of organizations that are helping parents actually homeschool. And they help to provide curriculum. They help to provide links to textbooks. They help to provide mentoring of these new, often untrained teachers in the home. And this is a civil society grown out of really nothing, not much of anything. But it doesn't remain a civil society focused just on curriculum and pedagogy. It quickly, and some would say on purpose, develops into a political movement. So soon, by the mid-1980s and 1990s, there are politically oriented homeschool organizations operating in just about every state that provide a political voice for families that are educating at home. Because educating at home, even if it's made legal, by the time of the late 1980s, early 1990s, doesn't make it easy. Doesn't mean that families don't face any challenges with local school boards or local administrators who are wondering what's going on in these homes. And a very active and effective set of lobbying organizations forms to provide a common defense. And that common defense is essentially boils down to leave us alone. Give us the exemptions to all of the educational rules that are being introduced, everything from testing to accountability to teacher standards to what have you. And so what starts as a civil society that is formed really just around the act of educating becomes politically influential. And so by the early 1990s, there isn't a legislator operating in any state government that would dare step foot into the world of homeschooling out of the fear of dozens and dozens of families being mobilized to arrive in the Capitol to oppose whatever they might be doing, even if what they were doing isn't going to directly affect homeschooling. Even just the possibility, some would say like the unlikely possibility that a new educational regulation might touch on homeschoolers is rejected outright. And so this group becomes very influential and active and easily mobilized during the 1990s as a common defense for these families to educate at home. And so the book is very much about a grassroots movement that forms in defense of homeschooling first, but soon it starts to take on other objectives that aren't so closely connected to the practice of homeschooling. They become involved in other things over time.
And you talk about how they sort of evolve into, at least ideologically, the Tea Party kind of paradigm that we see that rises up in after the election of President Obama. And that also is galvanized to protest at state houses early on in a very grassroots form. Can you thread the needle between the homeschool movement and your argument with regard to how that sort of connects to the Tea Party?
Yeah, absolutely. And because one of the arguments that the book makes is that many of the beliefs and the policy agenda of the Tea Party movement of 2009 and 2010 can be seen in what homeschooling advocates have been advocating for nearly two decades prior to. And this isn't just the educational agenda of the Tea Party movement. It's a set of anti-government, anti-institutional beliefs, ideologies, and policies connected with them that goes way back to the 1980s and some of the key visionaries that saw homeschooling as a revolution. And so some of the people that emerged in the late 1970s and early 1980s is people like R.J. Rushdoony, who was this fire and brimstone religious intellectual who sees homeschooling as connected to a common defense of a fundamentalist Christian way of life that he and others in his circle envision for the country. And that homeschooling is one way to reject the secularism that is seen across public schools. Recall that this is a time period after prayer in school has been rejected. And homeschooling is seen as a way to reintroduce some of these Christian beliefs into the education of children. And Rushdoony and others see this as an incredible opportunity. One of the acolytes of R.J. Rushdoony is a gentleman named Gary North. Gary North takes up the cause. Gary North is an economist, not a religious scholar, but his writings are informed by his Christian beliefs. And the New York Times writes at one point in a profile of Gary North in 2011 that he's the, and I quote, the largely unknown to the broader public, but he's an influential figure on the American far right and on the curriculum of Christian homeschoolers across the country. Gary North became known, and this may be of a moniker that he developed for himself, but as the Tea Party economist. And he sort of branded himself in this kind of way. North writes about homeschooling, and he writes about libertarianism. He writes at one point, and I quote, so let us be blunt about it. We must use the doctrine of religious liberty to gain independence for Christian schools until we train up a generation of people who know that there is no religious neutrality, no neutral law, no neutral education, and no neutral civil government. And by Christian schools, he means homeschools often, Christian homeschools. And so North sees, like Rushdoony, not just a way to do education, but actually to prepare a generation of students who are going to defend not just homeschooling, but a whole array of beliefs. And so North and Rushdoony feature in the very early history of homeschooling, but then North, at least, comes back again and is prominent in the Tea Party. And we see this with lots of people who are involved in the Tea Party, that some of their early work and their political education comes from their involvement in running homeschool organizations. So they go from running a homeschool organization to getting involved in running a Tea Party organization. And there's lots of sort of examples of this. But I think the central point that I try to make is that this sort of conservative and libertarianism that plays out in the Tea Party, and many have written about this more eloquently than I have, doesn't just happen in 2009, 2010. I argue that the organizational dimension of it happens in part because many of these people had been practicing the organizing and mobilization at the grassroots level in their own homes and with their neighbors in the name of homeschooling. And so without homeschooling, a lot of the practice of organizing wouldn't have happened that was so integral to making the Tea Party movement grow so quickly. And so I think there are very close connections between these two movements.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And one of the points that you sort of spend a lot of time writing about in terms of trying to distinguish things is that you're also sort of charting the charter school movement in your discussion of the homeschool movement, because it's another sort of chunk of education reform that is also going on at this time. And so for listeners who might be curious, can you explain a little bit about the distinction between the charter school movement and the homeschool movement? Because they do fall in somewhat different ideological camps, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right. From a distance, they both could be described as choice-based education. They both from a distance could be described as sort of quasi-market-based approaches to education. When you see somebody like Donald Trump talk about education, and he sure did not talk about education a lot when he was president, but when he did, he would often describe homeschooling, charter schooling, and school vouchers as very in common, as a set of policies that he didn't distinguish very much between. And I think many would sort of take away something similar, that they both sort of start from a similar premise that is critical of traditional public schools, that is generally supportive of giving parents choice in some fashion. You would be led to believe then that they share a political history, when in fact they really don't. Though they're happening at about the same time, homeschooling, the legalization of homeschooling precedes the adoption of charter school policies in nearly every case, so that by the end of the 1980s, homeschooling is legal and accepted in just about every state in the country, whereas charter school laws hadn't been passed. They wait until early 1990s. Charter school laws play out over the 1990s and early into the 2000s. So they arise at slightly different times, and they arise with a very different coalition of supporters. Charter school laws and charter school advocacy really started as the business community and local groups coming together, often in cities, whereas the homeschooling movement has been a much more rural and suburban movement. So where this has played out has also been different. And as a result, when we see these two movements talk about issues, and in the book I study the rhetoric used by some of the most prominent charter school and homeschooling organizations, they use very different language and very different framing of the problems of education. So charter schools are advocates are much more likely to talk about efficiency, much more likely to talk about the market, much more likely to talk about competition, or the lack of competition or the lack of efficiency they see in public schools. Homeschool advocates talk very little about efficiency. They talk very little about competition. They talk mainly about individual liberty. They talk mainly about rights, often the religious rights and parental rights. Charter school advocates don't talk about religious liberty or religious rights very much at all. Neither group, neither advocates for homeschools or charter schools talk about educational equity really at all. So one of the things they have in common is neither movement supporting charter schools or homeschooling talks very much about educational equity as a prominent feature of education policy. Advocates for public schools talk almost exclusively about educational equity being important. And so this is one of the ways that if we kind of look out across educational reformers, the ways that they are similar and different. And in the book, I make the argument that this is matters for the politics of charter schools and the politics of homeschools. Homeschool policies at the state level almost never are reversed. They never become less permissive. The exemptions that are given to homeschool families are almost never taken away. Whereas in the world of charter school policy, they often are reversed. New restrictions are placed either on the number of charter schools or on restrictions on what it means to be a successful charter school. So we see a lot more pushback in the world of charter school politics than in homeschooling politics. And this, I argue in the book, is because of its design. There are losers in the charter school politics world. That is, money is taken away from public schools when charter schools grow in numbers. Homeschools get no money at all from public sources. And so we don't see that same kind of zero-sum game playing out when we talk about homeschooling. And as a result, there are few organized opponents to homeschooling as we see in charter schooling. So what from a distance look very similar, in fact, are very very different when it comes down to it.
And one of the points that you make in the book, because you do sketch out the numbers associated with homeschooling, is if we think about the sort of number of children who are in schools in the United States, the homeschool numbers are quite small in comparison. And yet, part of, I think, your argument is that this is kind of a quiet revolution that has happened while nobody's really paying attention. And I would love for you to sort of make that argument, because that was, you know, when you're reading through the book, it's kind of like, this has all gone on and nobody's paid all that much attention to it.
Yeah, absolutely. But I can tell you who has paid attention to it. Every Republican who's been running for president over the last, let's say, 25 years has known that homeschool families are so well organized and so easily mobilized that nearly every Republican presidential candidate of the last 25 years has looked to homeschooling organizations for support. And it's not because homeschooling parents make up 25% of the voting population, even in the areas of the country where homeschooling is the most prevalent. We're still not talking about more than 10% of local students, and that's just a fraction of who's going to turn out and vote. It's not because they represent a large voting bloc. What they represent for many Republican candidates is a group of families and potential volunteers on campaigns. So in 2000, when Al Gore was facing George W. Bush, there were organizers who recognized that they could turn the Bush campaign into a mini curriculum, and they did that. There's a case in 2000 where organizers created what they called the Homeschoolers for George Bush, which was a curriculum played out in the fall of that year, where families could connect their homeschool, that is what was going on in their education, to the campaign, so that if the children went out and volunteered on a campaign, they'd get a certain number of points. If they worked very hard to turn out voters, get people registered, they would score points. So to such a great extent that when George W. Bush ended up winning the election, he thanked these organizations, these homeschooling organizations, for their help. He saw them as the foot soldiers in his election. Michelle Bachmann, Mike Huckabee, Ted Cruz, all look to homeschooling organizations and homeschool families, that is the most conservative of them, as effective volunteers, integral to their get out the vote campaigns, and as a consequence, a movement that has never been enormous in numbers has had this outside role to play in elections. Now, again, not all homeschoolers voted for Ted Cruz or Michelle Bachmann or George W. Bush. And in the most recent elections, what we've seen is it's somewhere around 60% of parents of homeschool children vote for the Republican candidate. So that was the case for John McCain, where he got about 60% of homeschool parents supporting his campaign. About the same percentage voted for Mitt Romney, and about the same percentage voted for Donald Trump in 2016. Interestingly, in 2020, I found that there was a small decrease in the amount of support among homeschoolers for Donald Trump. Small, a couple of percentage points. And one of the reasons for this, I think, is because what's happened to homeschooling over this time period is it's become less ideological rather than more. And that's because the numbers are growing and it's become much more diverse. This was a movement that for a long time was largely white, was very suburban and rural, but more recently it has become more diverse in terms of class, in terms of race, and I think as a consequence in terms of ideology. And this is in part because in 2020, unlike in 1985 or 1995, technology has made it much easier, and the cost of homeschooling has gone down a lot. And so this most recent election, I don't argue in the book because the book was published after the outcome, but in subsequent data analysis, it has seemed that maybe there's a slight turn. Now, the most conservative homeschool families remain dedicated to Donald Trump. What we see on the is the moderate homeschool parents turned away from Trump in 2020 in a way that they hadn't in 2016. And so that's part of the argument of the book, is that these families, as a result of leaving the public school system, have to find a curriculum. And when it comes to election time, they find a curriculum in getting involved in elections, and candidates for office haven't ignored this. In fact, they've embraced it because they recognize how valuable it can be to have families get out and get involved in helping them get elected.
So, I mean, again, this sort of movement is sort of coming to maturity in a certain sense. And as you note, there's a little bit more diversity. And now we've all done it over the past year of the pandemic. Although I know many people want to send their children back to face-to-face school. What do you see as the legs for this movement going forward in terms of, will it remain more captured by or based in the sort of religious right? Or is there going to be possibly, again, more of an expansion?
Yeah, what you see play out more recently over the last 5 to 10 years, and what I think I would anticipate in the future, is a moderation of the politics and ideology that is so has been so dominant in the homeschooling movement. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One of the reasons is that there are many more purposefully secular homeschool organizations, and they've been successful. Whereas in the past they really didn't exist at all. They have grown, and they're now, I think, much more effective in advocating for a very secular vision for homeschooling. So that's part of it. Is the most prominent organizations now include much more kind of moderate secular organizations, where in the past it was dominated by much more conservative organizations. At the same time, the most prominent homeschooling organization has become much more focused just on homeschooling. So there's an organization called the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, maybe, HSLDA. And whereas in the 1990s and 2000s, they were a player in conservative politics, not just conservative education politics. And that was because of their leadership. They have shifted their strategy over the last couple of years to be much more focused more narrowly on homeschooling, and haven't taken on a wider agenda that has taken them in the past into other conservative issues. So by narrowing their agenda, I think they're going to be much more focused. Now, I think their defense of homeschooling remains as strong as ever, but it's much less connected to other social policies. I think the third reason for moderation is kind of the demographic one. Which is the people who homeschool, I think, are doing it for different reasons, and some of those have played out over the last year, which is, I think, for some families going to be hard to go back to, especially if they've moved communities and their homeschooling now has taken them out of a community that they once were in, and so I think what we see there. Is a changing sort of the face of homeschooling has changed over this time period. Whether families go back to their back to their old in-class public or private school or charter school remains to be seen. There's evidence so far that hasn't happened universally, but the reopening of schools is not universal, and so when that actually happens, I think we'll know that better. But I think there are reasons to think in the future that the homeschooling movement won't be nearly as charged by its most conservative and right-wing advocates, and there'll be many more moderate and centrist advocates of homeschooling. Now, those moderate and centrist homeschooling advocates may strengthen the movement, may make it may have it grow in its numbers, but I think its political influence, especially in Republican presidential politics, may not be what we saw in the past.
And you talk about this also in the book in terms of the political landscape that is now sort of folding this in. As you said, it became the foot soldiers in the W. Bush campaign. But that this is now, even though it has grown up as a sort of grassroots parallel policy sphere, it's now part of the policy dialogue, in part because of things like vouchers and charter schools, so that the homeschool dialogue, I guess, is not as revolutionary as it was.
Yeah, there was a time period when the homeschooling movement rejected vouchers kind of outright. They rejected really any public financing as a first step to regulation. And so you see peculiarly state legislators sort of often supportive of homeschooling make recommendations to include homeschoolers in voucher plans or public financing, or to find ways for public funds to support homeschooling expenses in some fashion. And in the past, homeschooling organizations basically rejected that outright. And they said, thank you, but no thank you, because in their view, the money comes first and the regulation comes second. And they've always been first and foremost opposed to any kind of regulation of homeschooling. And that goes from what's taught to who is teaching it. In many states to this day, you don't need to have graduated from high school in order to be a homeschool teacher. You don't need an educational degree. The standards and testing are largely absent in most state rules. And homeschooling advocates in the past have been quite content with this and also content with having no money come to homeschooling families. Now, over the last year, there's really been a great change in that. And there have been numerous policies presented at the national level, but also at the state level, to make the expenses of homeschooling a tax write-off, to provide for greater public funding of the expenses of homeschooling. And homeschooling organizations, I think, have increasingly become much more comfortable with that. And that's perhaps because of their moderation, their recognition that that money maybe is available. But it remains unclear whether those strings that they've always feared are coming next. But for, you know, the last 4 years, homeschooling movement has had an advocate in Washington in the Secretary of Education, unlike an advocate that they've ever had in the past, Republican or Democratic administration. Betsy DeVos was a knowledgeable about homeschooling, had advocated for homeschooling policies prior to getting that position, was seen as a friend of the movement, even though homeschooling advocates didn't back Donald Trump in large vocally. In fact, some of the most prominent HSLDA and one of their former and most well-known leaders wrote a very prominent op-ed in the Washington Post, where he said, Donald Trump is not our candidate. We have supported Republican candidates in the past, and he is not somebody who we should support. Despite that, the homeschooling community got their person in the Department of Education. And Michael Farris, who wrote that op-ed, later showed up at all of the Supreme Court swearing-in ceremonies, because the larger socially conservative agenda that he and others had been advocating for, that homeschooling fit so naturally into, Donald Trump was seen as a success. So, oddly, the Trump years were a huge success for homeschooling, but could lead to the kinds of things that they had worried about for so long. And so you see them trying to walk that tightrope over the last year of wider acceptance and understanding and empathy with how difficult it is to homeschool. But also then what comes from that salience, and it could be more regulations, it could be more standardization, it could be some of the things that they have been so fearful of in the past, and that would pull homeschooling much more into the mainstream, possibly making it more standardized, making the outcomes much more widely known. In the past, we've known very little about homeschooling. We've known very little about reading proficiency, math proficiency, all the things that we know so well about public schools. When it's come to homeschooling, we've known very little. It could be in the future we'll know much more.
And the dynamic around this whole movement was also one that was state and local based, which is again kind of novel on some levels, but not really in terms of its grassroots movement. So this isn't necessary. It became a national movement, but it really operated along the lines of advocating for legal changes in the states. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's, you know, there in most ways, there is no federal, there has been no federal homeschooling policy as such. What federal homeschooling policy has basically meant in practice is don't talk about homeschooling. Don't include homeschooling in when you're introducing and making federal policy. And everyone's, you know, has been kind of okay with that. And that's in part because they haven't asked for very much in return. Most of the real action has played out at the state level. And so state homeschooling policy is really what allows families to opt out of formal schooling. Formal schooling that takes the form of either a public school or a private school or a charter school. That's either formally written into state law or written into some sort of indirect way so that to homeschool basically means to operate a home-based private school. But whether it's sort of formal homeschooling or de facto homeschooling, the real legislative action has always been at the state level. And local officials have kind of actually had little to do in many cases with homeschooling because in many cases, homeschoolers had little to do with public schools. Only very recently have local jurisdictions come to connect better with homeschooling, and that's in part because of declining enrollment in many parts of the country. So whereas in the past, a student who was educated at home wouldn't be allowed to take a class at a local high school, let's say. Let's say they wanted to take a class. The family was unable to teach Russian, Mandarin, astronomy. They in the past were just about always forbidden from taking that class, the individual class at a local public high school. Increasingly, that's possible. In the past, a student athlete would almost never be able to compete for a local team, nor would their team, their homeschool team, be able to compete against public or private schools. Increasingly, laws have been passed to make that possible. And so what we've seen over the last, let's say, 10 years, is homeschools have become more closely connected with local public schools and other local institutions. Libraries are really the most prominent. Libraries have come to embrace homeschool families, often dedicating large sections of a collection and rooms and space and invitations to homeschool families to use libraries, public libraries. That represents a change in how homeschool families have been integrated in local communities. Once cut off from many local institutions, really operating in this kind of parallel way, those lines have crossed more recently, and it's in part because localities and states have seen the need to connect these families much more to public schools.
And I mean, I know I've read and I've seen articles about the questions of student athletes or AP classes, particularly as an option that homeschool families or organizations are wanting access to for the students. It's a really interesting area because, as we talked about at the beginning, it sort of has been going on, but a little bit under the radar to a degree. And of course, the public school is a center of a community. And so, you know, taking a percentage of the people out of the public school and moving them into the private sphere is another challenge for democracy. And so how does this movement operate in that context?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, and you know, and my hope with the book is that it's read not just by those interested in education politics and education policy, because I think the argument that I make is true for the homeschooling movement in a way that it is for other things like gated communities. that are not always established by policy, but public policy decisions have been made on zoning and construction of public services to make them much easier in some parts of the country. And very similar things happen. If you live in a gated community, either with formal gates or with some other, you know, virtual gates, there's often a quasi bill of rights that establishes the rules and procedures about everything that your local town council would have been solely in charge of in the past. Democracy of a sort plays out within these communities that have been exempted or opted out of what others have remained a part of. It's true for homeschooling families that no longer are a part of a PTA, that no longer are as involved in local school board politics. When families who decide to homeschool make those decisions, it's analogous to other kinds of politics of opting out. Everything from occupational licensure and what it means when states allow certain occupations to opt out of the licensure procedures, that has an effect on the politics and regulation of those professions. Everything from individual retirement accounts to vaccination, to vouchers for housing and education, all share a common design, which is allowing people to opt out or gain exemptions from the rules that others play by. And there are consequences for democracy of that. But they're not the obvious consequence that I think a lot of people expected for homeschooling, which is once people opt out, they drop out. In fact, the opposite has happened in the case of homeschooling. People have opted out, but they haven't become less politically involved. They've become more politically involved. The act of opting out has empowered families to feel like their political voice and their political role is heightened. And I think this is a sort of a paradox and irony that we need to think about when we give other kinds of exemptions, exemptions that we would think mean that people will then kind of leave everything else alone, is really not the case. That these opt-out movements create powerful constituencies that will be involved not just in the narrow politics of that given policy, but will bleed over into other issues. And I think that's one of the parts of this book that I hope to engage people with is this idea of opting out and opting out of the COVID vaccine, and the consequence for political organizing seems like something that matters, that this is the opting out of this vaccination has obvious public health ramifications, but it also has political ramifications as well. And trying to understand those in real time is very hard. I would argue that we don't have to understand it just in real time. We can also look to analogous political movements that have played out that we can draw some lessons from. And the homeschooling movement, I think, is one of them.
So given that, what is it that you're working on now, Heath?
What am I working on now? I am working on a little bit trying to follow up on this project. There are a number of other things, including something unrelated to my research, that is related much more to trying to right some wrongs in the world of book publishing that I can't yet reveal the details of, but they will be revealed soon to the world. And I think it's a very exciting project that I hope to connect with the world. And I would love come this fall to come back on without a book to promote, but with a book-related project to talk about, and would love to come back and talk to you guys about the project and about how we hope it leads to more books, better books, books from a wider diversity of institutions. And maybe I'll leave it there, but I really do hope to come back to talk about that project soon.
I am very intrigued, and I'm happy to invite you back to the New Books Network to talk about that.
Wonderful.
Thank you for joining me today, Heath Brown, to talk about Homeschooling the Right, How Conservative Education Activism Erodes the State, published by Columbia University Press. I assume one can purchase this at Columbia University Press's website. Any brick and mortar stores with a cool online presence you want to give a shout out to?
Not that come to mind, but I do want to give a shout out to my editor, Stephen Wesley, who did the functional parts of editing a book, but so much more. And the consequence for me was a book that I truly, truly am proud of, not just the findings, but of the writing. And that wasn't done alone. And Stephen's work on this was so great. That if you have a book manuscript, you should pitch it to Stephen, because he will make the book better and more readable. And I can't think of anything that any of us want more than having people read the book and enjoy them. So I want to share the credit for the final version of this book with Columbia, all their editors, but specifically with Stephen Wesley.
And I will concur that this is a very nicely written book and is easy to read and lovely to read. So I appreciate the opportunity to read it. And thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.